Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. I'm Don Marsh. First, we'll take a look at a disturbing problem that concerns both the medical profession and law enforcement, opioid abuse. It's extensive, and often addiction to opioid-prescribed painkillers is the gateway to heroin addiction. Heroin overdoses are killing more and more Americans, often young Americans. Overdose deaths involving prescription opioids have quadrupled since 1999, and so have sales of these prescription drugs. Obviously, painkiller prescriptions begin in the doctor's offices, so what role can physicians play in nipping the problem in the bud? Our guest has some very specific ideas. That's Dr. Michael Boutros. He's director of the Barnes Jewish Pain Management Center. Doctor, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me, Don.
What a problem this is.
Very much so.
What's your take on it?
Well, this is being claimed in various newspaper articles as an epidemic, and I really do believe that this is an epidemic. Since 2009, there have been over 165,000 deaths just related to opioid overuse and medication overdoses. And so 40 people a day are dying from these medications, and it behooves us as a medical profession to start addressing this problem.
That's more people than are killed in automobile accidents.
That's correct. It's more than cocaine, heroin, and stimulant abuse combined per year.
How did this get out of hand?
Well, you know, it's a long story. So in the 1890s, the Bayer Corporation actually made its first fortune selling heroin and aspirin to treat cold and cough symptoms. And by 1911, it turns out that 1 in 400 Americans were actually addicted to opium. 1 in 400. It's an amazing, staggering number. So by 1914, the Harrison Narcotics Act was passed, and it regulated the importation and manufacturing distribution of opium in the United States. At the same time that this was happening, addiction wasn't recognized as a disease. And so physicians who were prescribing maintenance doses to their addicted patients faced legal issues like imprisonment, loss of their medical license, and whatnot. So it actually ended up leading to a reduction in appropriate treatment of legitimate pain in the United States. So there followed decades and decades of advocacy by different organizations, and a lot of articles were published on the safety or presumed safety of opioids. By 1997, the intractable pain statutes were adopted by a variety of states, by federal state medical boards, that we had a right and a moral obligation to treat pain. What ended up happening was that through a variety of channels and, you know, some would say different pharmaceutical companies, that the treatment of chronic cancer-related pain, end-of-life pain, ended up being stretched out into chronic non-cancer pain. And so pain management then suddenly became synonymous with opioid use. And unfortunately, it led to where we are, this unidimensional, unimodal approach.
I get the impression that doctors perhaps have been a little too quick to prescribe these painkillers.
It's true. And unfortunately, we as physicians aren't properly educated. There was a recent 2011 paper that was published out of Johns Hopkins. The amount of hours spent in U.S. medical school for education related to pain management is a whopping 9 hours. That's 0.3% of the total time spent in the U.S. medical school education system. For comparison, veterinarian schools spend more than 500 times more on how to treat pain in animals.
You know, I've often heard this over the years, that the interaction of chemicals is something that doctors should be conversant with, but just as you suggested, very, very little attention is given to that in medical school.
That's right, unfortunately.
Yeah. Well, some of the blame, I'll use that word, for this problem has to rest with the patients, because, again, it's my understanding that patients are demanding these medications.
It's unfortunate because a lot of this has to do with patient expectations. And like I said, this whole idea that pain management has become synonymous with opioid prescriptions and use has filtered down to the patients as well. And unfortunately, when patients come in an outpatient setting, such as their primary care physician, And if they are having sudden acute low back pain, they expect that prescription of an opioid to help them, whereas the new CDC guidelines that just recently were published really advocate to not use opioids as first-line therapy. And we do know that through a variety of different pieces of literature that things like acute low back pain can actually be well treated with, say, a muscle relaxant rather than an opioid.
Well, does Big Pharma play a role here? They do a lot of advertising, spend a lot of money on this sort of thing.
Yes. Probably the biggest culprit, I would say, or at least in terms of fingers being pointed, is Purdue Pharma, who are the makers of OxyContin. I know that when they were marketing OxyContin, you know, a lot of questions were being asked about the role of addiction. And in their marketing strategies, I know that they had clearly stated several times that because OxyContin is a long-term release opioid, that the risk of addiction and misuse was very low in taking that medication. And unfortunately, it was definitely a hand in how it's gotten out of hand, actually.
What is it about the opioids that actually kills people?
One of the biggest side effects of opioids is respiratory depression. So as they take care of their pain, they don't necessarily have the same effect on their respiratory center drive. And so people who may, in fact, be quite tolerant to opioids may not be tolerant to the respiratory side effects. So you could be increasing the doses of your opioids because it's not treating the pain. But while you're doing that, you're breathing less and less, and some people go to sleep and they don't wake up.
Is this one of those situations where over a period of time, if you're using these medications, they become less effective and therefore you increase the dosage? Is that what we're saying?
Absolutely. It's very clear. It's something called opioid tolerance. So over time, patients who are taking low doses of opioids, and if that's the only thing that they're taking to treat their pain, end up taking more and more to try to get the same effect that they had when they first started taking this medication. They can find themselves taking hundreds, if not thousands, of milligrams to satisfy those initial 10 or 15 milligrams that they had when they started.
You mentioned early on that we need to educate doctors somewhat better than we have been so far on this, and we'll talk more about that. But what about educating the patients?
Absolutely. I think that, and this is something that I say to a lot of my patients who come in, I think that in today's day and age, we think of everything as sort of a McDonald's drive-through. You come in, you have pain, you expect to get something to relieve it, and you're out the door, when in reality, very few things are like that, especially when it comes to pain management. So one of the things that I unfortunately have to spend quite a bit of time is trying to set that right expectation to the patients. Multidisciplinary approaches to pain management are really the best and most proven technique to coping with people's pain. And it might not necessarily take away the pain 100%, but it's trying to get you to a functional state. And so physical therapy, injections, exercise, different types of medications can be helpful.
Right. Patients need to know this.
That's right.
And they shouldn't be going into the doctor's office and screaming, "I want OxyContin," or
exactly.
whatever the prescription might be. Okay, let's talk a little bit now about the doctors. You know, if they're quick to write prescriptions because the patients are demanding it, how do you deal with that?
It's a balance of time and pressure, especially in an outpatient setting, because what's easier, to write a prescription or to take the time and discuss why it's not the right thing? And unfortunately, especially when it comes to proper education in our U.S. medical schools, and as well as satisfying patients' expectations without necessarily trying to correct them, we tend to go ahead and prescribe that opioid medication. And unknowingly, we start a process that is hard for us to get out of. Because once you start that prescription of an opioid, it's very easy for that patient to continue. And as we said, over time, opioid tolerance develops. So they come back in saying, "Doc, you know, it was helpful, but now it's not helpful as much. You know, what do you think about going up on that dose?" And again, to satisfy the patient, sometimes we end up having to go up on that dose when it's not the right thing to do, even getting them there in the first place.
And there are many cases I know, and you do too, I'm sure, of a patient who finally doesn't need them anymore but still has half a bottle full in the medicine cabinet. And problems can begin that way too for other people in the household.
Absolutely. In fact, it's a staggering statistic. National Survey on Drug Use and Health came out every year. The last one was, I think, published in the 2013 data. And it showed that over two-thirds of patients who take illicit drug use, who use opioids for non-medical reasons, have received it from a friend or a relative. And if you look further into that data and look where did the friends or relatives get that opioid medication, it was from a single physician. It was a prescription. It was legitimate. And it was lying around in their house. It's not locked up. It's available in the bathrooms. And that's how it gets started.
And it's a vicious kind of cycle. And then when that runs out, often because it is cheap, it is inexpensive, these users will turn to heroin.
That's right.
Right.
2009, there was an ultra rapid assessment paper that was published. They looked at different law enforcement personnel and key personnel, even drug dealers and patients who are addicted to heroin. They asked them, where did they get started? And they said that exact same thing, that they started with opioids that were available. And when they found that it was harder to obtain, it was just a lot more cheaper to go to the streets and use heroin.
How close a cousin is heroin to the opioid medications?
Heroin is an opiate, yeah. And so it works on the same receptors.
Well, if it's so inexpensive, why aren't they using that as a medication?
Yeah, unfortunately, it's one of those things where being unregulated and the way that they're taking it, it lends itself to a variety of other problems, with IV syringes and causing all sorts of infections and heart problems. It just ends up being a vicious cycle.
Well, and it's obviously a killer. We'll continue this conversation. We'll talk more about those alternatives that you mentioned a little while ago. But we have some people interested in getting into the conversation. We'll bring them in as well. Back in a moment to continue our conversation. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Now back to our conversation with Dr. Michael Boutros of Barnes-Jewish Hospital. The Missouri legislature, this past session, did not pass an opioid database proposal. A number of states, I think maybe all but Missouri, do have such a setup. How badly is this needed?
What you're referring to is something called PDMP, or Prescription Drug Monitoring Program. It's basically a tool that's used to address prescription drug diversion and potential abuse. And you're right, Don, every state outside of Missouri has addressed that and has a PDMP in place. I think my understanding is that since 2011, every year, this has been brought up to legislation and unfortunately hasn't been passed. I think the main argument has been concerns over patient privacy and security. How badly important this is can be evidenced from some of these other states. What data do we know? And it's interesting, the question is very timely because last month, June of 2016, there was a recent article that was published in Health Affairs magazine that looked at prescription drug monitoring programs in 24 states that had it between 2001 and 2010. And they showed a 30% reduction in the prescription of class 2 opioid medications for those states. 2012 in New York, the state showed an 85% reduction in patients who were drug-seeking getting illegal prescriptions. So there are a variety of different states that have shown benefits. It's important to understand that there are obviously limitations, but it has been shown to be part of that monitoring tool.
And even with this, almost 30,000 people a year are dying of overdoses.
Unfortunately. Yeah. However, at least we are starting to see that trend downwards in that opioid prescription problem.
Let's get the listening audience into the conversation. I'll start with a tweet first. You addressed, mentioned cancer earlier. Thomas is tweeting, what about opioids for terminal cancer patients?
So it's very important to understand that the CDC guidelines that were recently published do not have anything to do with cancer or end-of-life care or palliative care or even acute pain in patients who are in the hospital, who are admitted into the hospital. These are really limited to outpatient chronic pain, which is a big problem, but of course, it is not part of this spectrum.
Okay. Let's go to the phones. Dave joins us from St. Charles. Dave, thanks for being with us. Go ahead.
Hey, Don. Appreciate it. And Michael, thank you for your insight. Two things. I was in the ER, and the blowback to this overprescription, I was looked at like a drug seeker, and to the point of having security outside my door because they didn't want to give me proper pain, you know, medication. So the blowback is harmful to the people that are not drug seeking. And secondly, real quick, is to the general public, if I think I can trust a doctor who's had 9 hours of education on prescription of pain medication, I am a fool. You know, the patient is responsible for this. And ultimately, like anything else, it will be financial change that corrects the system, either malpractice litigation or the patient being, you know, asked to sign off, you know, through indemnification.
Thank you, Dave. Sorry to cut you off, but our time is starting to get away. What do you think?
It's definitely a pendulum. We have to be very careful. Like I said, these guidelines and all this discussions really have to do with the outpatient chronic setting. So when patients show up to the ER, yes, of course, that's a big hot spot for some of these problems. But we need to take a step back, reevaluate, and see exactly what we're doing here. Because, of course, the gold standard when it comes to pain is going to be an opioid. So if we need to treat that in an acute setting, we need to do that. However, how we manage it long-term is what we're really talking about.
Right. Let's bring in Terry calling from St. Louis. Terry, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes, Don. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm a person that is a advocate believer of monitoring the drug. However, there are people that are suffering from a lot of chronic pain, arthritic pain. I have it, you know, and I hurt every day. But when I hear a lot of people saying that if you take these drugs, then it's going to lead to heroin. I'm not trying to do heroin. I'm not trying to do a high. I'm just trying to manage my pain. So I just want to speak for the people that have legit pain, that's not trying to do anything dishonest, but take care of their pain.
Terry, thank you.
You make a very good point. No one's saying not to prescribe opioids. What we're trying to say is that there are also other medications that can help, especially with arthritis. And so, yes, opioids can definitely be a part of it. But we know that long term, we don't want to be crossing a certain threshold in terms of the amount, because as we keep going up and up with these dosages, you end up becoming more opioid tolerant and might not be helpful. But you're absolutely right. Opioids help for certain people in certain situations. We just have to do a better job of monitoring the dose that you're at and making sure that what you're doing with the opioid, if you're more functional, if you're able to get up off the couch, lead a relatively normal life, that's important. But we don't want to be just treating for the sake of a number.
Right. Let's bring in Chris now. Chris, I'll ask you please to make it a quick question or comment, please.
Yeah, thank you. I appreciate it. And I had some trouble with chronic migraine. And over time, as that tolerance kind of built up, I actually found that it was doing more harm than good. And the more preventative, like diet, exercise, those kinds of things helped a lot more. Problem was, I had a hard time getting it covered all through insurance. How are the insurance companies responding to more preventative actions as opposed to just masking it with a pill?
So more and more insurance companies are starting to look at other ways of trying to take care of this. Certain insurance companies cover a certain amount of physical therapy and exercise programs, And like I said, you know, the Washington University Pain Management Center has always been a multidisciplinary clinic. We always try to go about it the exact same way that you mentioned. Like I said, the key is not to necessarily focus on one thing as the end-all, be-all answer for your pain management needs.
Right. We thank you for that call. Let's talk a little bit now in the time we have left about the alternative pain management options. And you've introduced something called radiofrequency cooled ablation. Do I have that right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. It's one technique in a vast array of things that we have at our disposal that can help with pain. We've used cooled radiofrequency ablation. It's been around for a long time. Radiofrequency ablation as a concept has been around for decades, and basically what it entails is targeting small, tiny nerves, not major nerves, just nerves that can relay sensory information from these arthritic joints, low back pain, knee pain. And if we numb up those nerves and your pain is improved as a diagnostic measure, then we have a better sense that that is one of the causes of your pain. And so we can essentially zap those nerves with this radiofrequency ablation, and it can provide relief anywhere from 6 months to a year. The nerves will grow back, but of course we can always repeat the procedure. And it's been a mainstay for a lot of my patients. They don't need to be on any medications when they're on this.
Expensive?
It's covered by insurance.
Well, good. That is always good news. Yeah. I saw an article in the New York Times recently in researching for this program, and they wrote about a therapy harp as a musical instrument that has been used.
Yeah.
Well, does that sound like something that could work to you?
Well, there's definitely a lot of alternatives that have been shown to be helpful. I mean, what essentially that is doing, it's part of what we call cognitive behavioral therapy, distraction techniques, things of that sort. And it's very clear that those have a role in pain management. Uh-huh. And in that article, they were using it, you know, as patients were waiting in the ER, for example.
It's worth trying, that's for sure. I want to thank you, Dr. Michael Poutros, for being with us, director of the Barnes Jewish Pain Management Center. This has been a fascinating discussion. Obviously, people have a lot to learn about that, both in the physician's office as patient and the physicians themselves. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me, Don.
This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU.